Bret Hart.
Until the spring of 1994.
For to listen to what's been saying.
The spring of 1994.
I'm most sadly lucky.
And that's about it for my part of this CD. I'm Chris Brooks in Newfoundland. Bye. I'll see you in the ether.
You've been listening to Radiant Dissonance, a series...
91.3 FM CJTR Regina Community Radio. Thanks for their generous support. Mysteria Gift and Design Gallery, 2706 13th Avenue. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily shared by Radius Communications Incorporated, operators of 91.3 FM CJTR.
When you're growing up in a small town.
Well, it's Wednesday morning, so it's time for Untitled, your weekly doorway, window, whatever, into art events that are happening around Regina. As usual, I am your host, Felipe Diaz, and joining me is Margaret Pasai. Good morning, Margaret.
Good morning, Phil. You're looking very radiant today.
Radiant. Oh, thank you. I must be emitting rays of light or something.
Positively radioactive.
So, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, strangely, Phil.
This is a loaded question, of
course. We're going to talk about Phil. Actually, we're going to go to the University of Regina Student Gallery, and we're going to use an exhibition there, an installation by three artists, as sort of a jumping off point to discuss the notion of memory. And I don't know, Phil, maybe you can fill us in on the details of what that exhibition is called and the three people involved and what their pieces are. Because I don't know if you consider it three separate pieces or just one whole installation.
All those are good questions. the exhibition is at the Fifth Parallel Gallery, which is in the Riddell Center at the University of Regina. It's called Three Blind Mice. And it's a series of video pieces that are sort of linked together thematically, and also there's a relationship between them that is expressed in terms of the way things are set up and the way it's all put together. The exhibition features three artists: myself, Kim Morgan, and Tammy McGrath. And what I find interesting about the show, like when we talk about it in terms of individual pieces or collaboration, I think this is where it starts to deviate a bit for me, because I don't think of it in terms of individual pieces, but it kind of is a collaboration, but it kind of isn't, because we have these individual pieces that are each communicating with the other in a particular way on the subject of memory. And the way that the different kinds of memories that we can interact with and that we normally interact with. So I'll give you a description of the exhibition, and then we can go from there as well.
Yeah, when you walk up to the gallery, normally the Fifth Parallel has lovely glass doors that allow you to see what's inside, and you guys apparently have painted the doors with black to kind of give some privacy and some darkness when you walk into the space.
Yeah.
And then when you enter into the space, it's a semi-darkened room with three garment-type things hanging on the walls. There's a man's suit jacket and shirt, and is
tie.
There a tie?
Yeah,
I thought so.
Shirt and tie, yeah.
And it's a little bit dusty. I guess memory involves that. Then there's a trench coat on the opposite wall.
Yes.
And is that a woman's trench coat? It was a little bit gender neutral. I thought basically that each garment represented each of the three artists or blind mice.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we were going for.
And the third one, of course, is a plastic garment bag. And because I know Kim Morgan works with a lot of latex, I immediately made the association between like the bag and Kim. But it turns out you were saying that Kim was reminded of her mother and her grandmother. And
right. Yeah, and so what the garments?
I'm sorry, not that they're bags, but that they store their clothing in garment bags.
Well, that's what I understood. what the exhibition does is it instead of putting up title cards, sort of describing the works, what we've done is forced a bit of recollection on the part of the viewer. In the sense that each one of those garments references one of the artists involved, in a particular way that is about, you know, remembering what that artist has done, which it kind of privileges those people who have seen work that we have done before.
Well, I'd say that's pretty true, because how can you remember something you don't know?
Exactly.
So I've seen you in a performance where you wore that suit and then, you know, fantastically took all those clothes off.
Exactly.
To reveal your Superman shirt. I haven't seen Tammy, though, with the trench coat, so...
Right, but at the same time, like, the videos have credits on them as well, right, which give you another frame of reference for
right,
each one of
right.
those things.
And so to get to the videos, in the center of the room, there's a padded bench.
Well, I just want to go back to the garments, because I think that, for me, the suits and all the outfits speak... also towards the memory of the artists themselves in a lot of ways, much the same way that the videos are characterized.
They stand in for stuff that you remember.
Exactly. And so much the way that the videos characterize a particular thought or a particular idea, the suits or the garments do that as well. Kim Morgan and the garment bag, I mean, she's talking a lot about how her mom and her grandmother make use of that kind of object. And they have throughout their entire lives, and that she's making associations to a family history through that particular item. So something as benign or as innocuous as a garment bag becomes a symbol of a larger reconstructed memory.
See, and I just finished watching a Columbo episode where the murdered victim was stowed away in her fur storage bag and stuck in a wall in the bathroom.
Okay.
So garment bags for me are just kind of creepy.
Well, I'd like to... That's a good point, because I would say that the show in general is creepy. And it's in a lot of ways this whole investigation of memory and the idea of entering into these sort of darker recesses of one's mind, like just
hence the darkened gallery room.
Yeah, just sort of plumbing the depths of what you remember can be a little creepy in a lot of ways, and not creepy in sort of like a horror movie kind of way, but you know, creepy in the sense that it can be a little unsettling. For
in an existential way.
Yeah.
If exactly. we were to understand what you're saying on the video.
Exactly.
Maybe we should talk about the videos then.
Okay. So.
So in the center of the room, there's a padded bench, and then there are three television sets with headsets on the bottom, and there's a DVD player playing loops. And I actually know enough about DVD players that I was able to hit the jump back button, and so I was able to start the video at the beginning and watch it from beginning to end. And then there's a microphone that hangs down from the ceiling that's attached to another piece of equipment, and there's a soundtrack that's playing in the larger gallery space, which appears to be the three artists' voices discussing their various concepts of memory that they were sort of dealing with in their piece. So you don't have to like listen to the videos, you could just sit on the bench and listen to the whole soundtrack, but then you can also put on the headphones and access maybe just what's being said on the DVD.
Exactly.
Things.
Yeah.
But of course there's a lot of sound that bleeds back and forth
right.
between the gallery space and what's being said.
Oh yeah. And it's not meant to be. I mean, you know,
I think that your thoughts are like that sometimes, you know.
Yeah. Memory is a layering effect, right?
Uh-huh.
And different things pierce through different layers at different times. So it's I mean, if we try to construct a visual image of what memory is, I mean, we...
And this is a very interesting notion. This is what I'm very excited about, so continue.
We could imagine it as sort of like a plane, right? Like a field or something in which there are a lot of things, but above it there's another field, and above it another field, and above it another field. And then there are some ideas that stand out.
So you're actually picturing an onion. With a skewer going through it.
Yeah, with a variety of skewers going through it, right? And so you have these other ideas or recollections that pierce different layers of memory and start to come through the other side.
And so, like, an obvious one would be, like, a parent, right, that you've known at a very young age and that you know at an older age, but that they are this one sort of concept or tower or skewer
exactly.
going through these layers of memory.
Yeah, and so you know, what appears visible on one layer, like you may be thinking about, here's an example, right? You may be thinking about, you may be thinking about the idea of traveling places, right? And that might bring up the idea of your little red wagon when you were a kid and the way that you used to walk around with the little red wagon and then travel from one place to another via this little red wagon. And then later on you may think of the first car you ever bought, or you may think, different stages in your life will recollect different ideas about what travel is, and they're all memories that you've used to construct this idea of travel.
Now, we've just finished describing Phil's idea that memory is like an onion with skewers in it. And I have in front of me an exhibition catalog with a completely unrelated exhibition. But the thing that I liked about this catalog is that it talked about different memory scholars. I had no idea there was a branch of thought that dealt with exclusively the idea of memory and how it is that we remember and the structure. Right. And it sort of makes reference in the text to the different kinds of historical thoughts. And apparently the Augustinian view of memory is that it's classically materialistic in the sense that memory is seen as a kind of container, a place within which past experiences are kept. And that would be like a box with marbles in it, right? And each
exactly.
memory is a discrete marble.
Yeah.
Which is as opposed to your view, Phil, where the memories are sort of interconnected.
Yes, yeah.
Now, Phil, you also talk about on your DVD piece, and when you listen to what is essentially a narrative, like on the TV set are the lips moving,
right. Yeah.
Which are then out of sync with your voice on the soundtrack of the DVD, and apparently that's on purpose.
Yes.
Which, you know, when you walk into any gallery situation, usually what you see is on purpose.
Yeah.
So you just have to take it for face value. But you talk about having a photograph of yourself as a small child, and you don't, like, you remember yourself as a small child, and you remember this photograph, but you're not sure if you remember it because of the photograph or because you have a genuine memory of that. And so the idea is, well, how is memory constructed then? Like, do you have these photographs as memory aids?
Yeah, well, it's for me, it's an even larger concept than just how memory is constructed, but how are we in turn... Like, what do we remember? Can we be sure that what we're remembering is what actually happened?
Mm-hmm.
And then we tend to assemble our own identities. We tend to make who we are out of what we remember.
Yeah, so Sunset Boulevard, right? Like, you've got an old movie actress who's
right.
starting to confuse her life with the movie she's been in.
Exactly.
Or Ronald Reagan,
Yeah, exactly.
Another right. great example of an actor who's going in and out of his life and his memories, and you're like, okay, is this real or is it Memorex?
Exactly.
To bring up another stupid pop culture reference.
So then the question that I'm posing throughout this thing is, I mean, I remember this, I remember looking at this photograph. I can place myself within the situation of the photograph. I can place myself within the position of someone being photographed or someone taking a photograph, but I do not, I don't actually remember going through the process of that particular photograph.
Mm-hmm.
Yet I use that photograph
to remember that house.
To remember that particular place at that particular time, and then that recollection, that particular place, particular time, has an influence over my decisions right now in this place and time.
So, and then in this exhibition catalog that I'm reading here, they talk about autobiography is sort of a second reading of experience, and it somehow is an interweaving of experience and consciousness, and in the end, memory becomes an interpretive act,
mm-hmm.
the end of which is an enlarged understanding of the self. And I think that's sort of what you're looking at, sort
yeah.
of memory and autobiography.
Yeah, and so when I made the video, and I it's the video is just a close-up of my mouth talking about the
story. So why are you out of sync?
And so then by shifting the soundtrack, right, just a little bit, just slightly off,
mm-hmm.
then I was hoping to evoke that particular... I was hoping to do a couple things. One was to demonstrate that my recollection is a constructed one, right? So by showing you a video that...
So I'd heighten the idea that the television, the video, is a construct, so you don't get seduced by the lips talking.
Exactly. So you're staring at the lips and you're listening to the sound and you're noticing that something's a bit wrong, and then hopefully at that point you start to think, well, you know, video is just it's another medium, right, that... With which we construct an idea.
Yeah, we're not really in your head hearing these thoughts.
Exactly.
We're watching a video, and it could all be bullshit.
Yeah, and so...
In fact, I want to see those scars the cat left on your head.
They're not
Go
there.
On, lift your hair.
They're not there. I lied. But, that story is true, and it's not true at the same time.
See, but that's the problem with memory, right?
Exactly.
It's essentially subjective.
Yeah.
And that your memory of an event and my memory of an event are two entirely different things, even though we were both there.
Right. So, again, by shifting the soundtrack slightly off, then you can start... It takes you out of that sort of realm of disbelief a bit, and you start to focus on the fact that it's, you know, it's a constructed setting, and this is a constructed idea.
No, I would disagree with you. It doesn't take you out of the realm of disbelief. It causes you to disbelieve.
Right, okay.
And what we're referencing there is the famous quote about the seduction of movies, right?
Yeah.
Which neither one of us can actually remember, but somehow there's a willing suspension of disbelief.
Yeah.
And so what you're doing is you're trying to get the person to not being so willing to suspend their disbelief.
Exactly. And then focus on the construction of it. The other thing that it kind of does, which I really like as well, by shifting the sound a bit as well, is it makes it all a bit uncanny. Earlier I was talking about how the show is a little creepy in that sense.
Okay, the uncanny is kind of a buzzword that's going around the art world. I've heard lots of curators talk about how lovely the uncanny is, and I don't know. I think it's just a piece of jargon. What is your feeling of the uncanny?
Oh, I definitely do not think it's just a piece of jargon. I think it's an experience that we all go through, and that it's really difficult to summarize in like a sentence or two.
Which is why all the curators are really eager to experience the uncanny.
Yeah, what it is basically is going through an experience that is slightly jarring. Or,
oh my God, it's all coming back to me in a flash. It's all connected to Sigmund Freud and psychoanalysis,
yes.
Which is why the curators are crazy for it.
Yeah.
So the uncanny has a particular psychoanalytic jargon meaning.
Yeah. Yeah,
which I can't remember what that is, but you'll tell us, right?
Yeah, I'll try. I'm going to use some very generalized crib notes to do this. But my understanding of the uncanny is based. It comes out of the death drive, which is
Sigmund Freud.
Which is Sigmund Freud, right? So
and that's a willing suspension of disbelief, because he says that we, you know, just our act of being alive is to seek death.
Right. Yes, absolutely. But what that is about is there are two motivating forces in our life at any given point. One is the pleasure principle. So we
do stuff that we want to do because it's fun.
Because it feels good. And
eating, really, having sex.
Exactly. And then there's the death drive, which is all about the loss of identity. Right. So what you want to do, and this is, I think, falling in love kind of falls into the notion.
Yeah, only Sigmund Freud would like talk about, you know, falling in love, that wonderful experience is the loss of conscious self as you merge into somebody else's identity.
Exactly. Well, that's basically the experience that he's trying to depict, right? Is that what we do is we try to shed part of ourselves and insert ourselves into a concept or another person or whatever, in order so that we become a part of a larger whole.
Yeah, and Sigmund Freud talked about how women are really good at this because, you know, they're a little bit masochistic.
I don't even want to go there. So the uncanny, again, like, and it's kind of a difficult concept to understand, but it's...
Oh, I think we've covered it.
it's those situations or those experiences that bring us a little bit closer to the death drive and to that loss of identity. And it's not an unpleasurable experience, and it's not even an undesirable one, but it's linked with these notions of death. And so people get a little bit turned off.
No, but not death, like you're going to fall off a cliff and be dead, but death of self in terms of being someone who's completely on an island by themselves. Because you're talking about merging with someone else, so yeah. You're losing yourself, selfness is dying.
Right, so that whole
It's
idea.
All in really negative terms for, I think, which are nice experiences. Yeah,
exactly, so the whole idea of, like, no man is an island.
But Sigmund would say that, you know, men want to be islands.
Right. Well, forget Sigmund for a second. Let's just continue with psychoanalysis. But no man is an island. You're definitely trying to do that, is get rid of that idea of being, you know, an individual in space. In fact, you're part of a larger community or a larger sense of society, right?
So to talk about the other two videos.
Yes, we're moving on.
Because we're starting to talk about different cultural, I mean, by invoking psychoanalysis, and which is sort of the core of Western thought, and Sigmund Freud, and sort of, you know, very rational ways of looking at the self. We're looking at really culturally specific ways of understanding the self and memory.
Exactly.
And that's kind of what you were talking about, Tammy's piece, which is entitled...
Dona Quixota.
Dona Quixote.
Dona Quixote. We're going to argue about this one. And so
she's making reference to Cervantes' text, Don Quixote.
Don Quixote, yeah. And then...
And she starts off with this lovely shot of, like, the wind turbines in Saskatchewan.
Exactly, right.
And so those are the windmills that Ton...
Yes.
Is, yeah. You know, tilting out.
And
but
she's riding a bike with a horse head attached to it, and she's wearing a pot on her head as well, much the same way that Cervantes is depicted, right? Like, he's riding the horse, and he's got, like, some sort of armor on, but the armor is, like, bits and pieces, and one of the things is a pot.
Well, he's a bit of a silly knight.
Yeah. So,
Now, you were telling me that Tammy actually feels a strong affinity with the text in her life.
Yeah,
and so she's interpreting her life
right,
in accordance to this text.
Yeah, and so what... and again, this is my understanding of her piece, and she talks about it a little bit differently. But my understanding is that, again, you know, if we start to look at the way that we construct identity and the way that we construct ourselves within space or time, that there are also outside influences that have effect on that. And those are these cultural memories that we draw upon, right?
So books and movies that we've seen.
Exactly. Books, movies.
Rock concerts we've gone to.
Yeah, other
church we went
doing
to.
Things. Yeah. So what those things have an effect as well in the way that we depict ourselves and the way that we experience the world. And our memories of them are the way that is mediated, right? So we internalize an experience into our memory, and then we turn around and then voice that back through whatever means that we feel is necessary.
Did I say this quote already? Another scholar on memory theorizing that autobiography is driven by a search for order. Man, I think this is in The Inclusive Man, creates, in fact, by the very act of seeking the order that he would have. So that, you know, you're going back through your life and you're trying to impose order on the random events.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've got another quote here. The art of memory is a complex tool of knowing whose practice has changed over the centuries. In the late Renaissance, the art of memory became a method of description, discovery, and synthesis of the outside world. And this would be as opposed to the Augustinian view that memory is a box that you keep stuff in.
Exactly, right? So
it's a tool of knowing, a method of description.
Right, right. It's a dialectic.
And dialectic is a really fancy Marxist term for a conversation between two concepts that result in a synthesis.
It's a Hegelian term.
Actually. Oh, is it? Yeah. Okay, Marx, Hegel. They drank at the same cafe, didn't they?
But it's essentially just that. It's this idea of an argument, right, in which there is a...
The thesis.
The thesis.
The antithesis, which is the opposite.
Synthesis.
And between those two...
Is the synthesis.
The synthesis.
Right, and so I mean, what that person is espousing about Renaissance understanding of memory is based in this idea that... memory are ways of interpreting the world, and there are the arguments that we use to do them, right? So they are the thesis and antithesis that will come up, and then our interpretation of it will be the synthesis.
Now, how this fits with Tammy's work, I'm not sure, but something that was really interesting when I was looking at her work just physically, because I've seen a lot of video pieces and a lot of film pieces, is that she's deliberately added a whole bunch of scratches, yes, and graininess to her film,
right,
which kind of references really old movies. And one would think that she's seeking to add an air of authenticity and sort of the past with those scratches. But to someone who's seen, like, actual old movies and scratches, they're kind of fake and bake. Especially since they go over, like, the little digital text sections.
Yeah.
Which are on top of video snow.
Yeah.
Like her little intertitles. So, I don't know. In one case, you have her invoking visual code for age and authenticity, and on the other hand, it's not authentic. But it was kind of an interesting thing. Like,
well, it's a balance between the two. Like, you know, again, we have to consider who the audience coming into the gallery are, and for the most part, we're hoping, crossing our fingers and hoping, that they're not going to be people who have had, you know, a huge amount of experience in video editing.
Well, no, I think it's just I think it's interesting, right? Because video and digital technology gives you this ability to have a crystal clear,
right,
picture of,
right,
the world.
Right.
And I think it's very similar to your out-of-sync lips, right? That you have these scratches,
right,
on that invoke this older medium that sort of talk about age and memory. And it's these, she's trying to get you into a different place,
right,
than just watching a TV show.
Well, that sounds great. I'm going to go with that one. That one sounds really good.
So then we get into Kim Morgan's piece. And now I know that Kim Morgan works with a lot of latex and that she's currently making a latex cast of a house, which is part of her master's thesis, which will be on exhibition in the Mackenzie at Christmas or this fall?
Yeah, around November. The end of November, we'll be seeing Kim Morgan's exhibition at the Mackenzie. She'll also be in To Conjure, which is an exhibition happening at the Dunlop at around the same time.
In November.
So she'll have a bit of a presence in the city around November. So
we'll have her on the show to talk about it.
But you can definitely contrast and compare all the works that she's done as well.
Yeah, now Kim in the past has done like a latex cast of a tree that hung in last year's Lantern Festival.
Yes.
And she's made the aluminum ants that are in the park.
Right.
Which is not latex. But I was making a balloon lantern this year at this year's Lantern Festival, and there's a really weird sound as you come back the next day and your glue and tissue paper has dried on the balloon, and then you pop your balloon and peel the balloon away, and it's like this creepy, weird noise. And I recognize that sound on her video piece.
Right.
It's basically her pulling this latex off the walls of the house. But for someone who went into the show who doesn't know Kim's practice with latex at all, or that she's making latex cast of houses, they watch the video section of her work and was immediately thinking about like all the other places that we've seen weird flesh and latex interacting in kind of a cocoon-like manner, which is to say horror movies where aliens are about to be born.
Yeah, you know, and I would think out of all the works that elicit the uncanny, I'd think that Kim's is probably the strongest one in that degree.
Yeah, and so Kim, you said, was hoping to talk about the really visceral components of memory, like the memory and the body connected somehow.
And again, in my understanding of what she's talking about, I mean, she's interpreting memory from a body sense as much as from a sort of philosophical sense, and she's, you know, really literally peeling away layers, right, of memory and trying to get at whatever core is within there. But it's all about a body action of peeling, and it's about the latex looks like skin, you know, and so there are ways that memory, you know, lives in on us and just on the surface of us.
We've talked about how scars evoke memories, that that the body has scars and you look at them and they're memories of different things that you've done. And it's just thinking about body memory, like anyone who's walked up and down a staircase that they're quite familiar with and then sort of lost track of where they were and missed a step. Like, that's a real act of discovering body memory, right? That you have this physical memory of where the steps are, and then there's not, like, the top step, and you kind of, like, thump down. You're like, oh, my gosh,
exactly.
I missed that step, right?
Yeah.
So your body really has a strong memory. My partner that was discussing this video of Kim's with me brought up the idea of birth, and that birth is a memory that you don't have, because they were thinking a great deal of birthing. They were watching Kim's piece, just how organic it was.
Okay, so we're totally out of time. In fact, we've gone over a bit. But again, the exhibition is at the Fifth Parallel Gallery. It's called Three Blind Mice. It's up till the end of this week, so it's almost done. And it's about memory and exploring different ways that memory interacts with our own identities.
Thank you very much, Phil.
Yeah, thank you.
An impressionist. He looks at a log. He doesn't know who he is staring at this log. And surrealist memories are too amorphous and proud. While those downtown macho painters are just alcoholic. The trembling impressionist. There's a trembling impressionist. There's a trembling impressionist. There's a trembling impressionist.